you'll notice on LinkedIn, people like your opinion on things. Not all people like the factual stuff, right? They want to hear from what you have to say about certain things. I try to apply that same thing within the blogging content itself. We're not just doing like a factual type of piece here. Maybe there's some of that, but a lot of it is like, what is the business's take on this? Or what is the owner's take of this? And I try to get them to apply that within the content. So most of my customers, I'll send a draft to them before it, but I have different sections where like they need to apply their own thoughts in. Sometimes it's quotes, so got to have their quotes. And then I'll have certain sections where I know this is a little too AI heavy. Can you make some changes to these two paragraphs, imply your own thoughts in there, or send it to your marketing team and they do it? And that's how I try to deal with it to get more uniqueness within the content.
Hi, and welcome to the Optimize Podcast. My name is Nate Matherson, and I am your host. On this weekly podcast, we sit down with some of the smartest minds in content marketing and SEO. Our goal is to give you perspective and insights on what's moving the needle in organic search. Today, I'm thrilled to sit down with Jesse McFarlane. Jesse is the owner of Spearpoint Marketing, an SEO marketing agency. Today's episode is jam-packed. Jesse and I will chat about building backlinks, SEO for SaaS companies, content marketing on LinkedIn, and more. Jesse, thank you so much for coming on the Optimize Podcast. And this episode of the Optimize Podcast is brought to you by Positional. You probably know by now that our public launch is on March 26th, but there's still time to take advantage of beta pricing and beta perks by signing up for our private beta ahead of the public launch. You can book a time with me to learn more about the private beta on our website at positional.com, or you can reach out to me directly at nate@positional.com. We've got a number of tools for content marketing and SEO teams, and we'd love for you to check it out.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The first question I ask all of our guests is, how did you get into the world of content marketing and SEO?
That's a really good question. So I started my career out in the fitness industry. I was like a personal trainer and was living that life. But at some point, I kind of hit like a plateau and I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. So I went back to school and got my MBA. And one of the very first classes was marketing technology. And this was around like 2007. And like digital marketing was just kind of like in its infancy stage. And I started getting really interested in it. And like, you know, I knew about like Facebook because that was relatively new. I think it was still called the Facebook at that point. Like it was just starting to transition to Facebook. But that's all I knew. And I was starting to get really interested in it. And I started studying it more. Eventually, I created my own online personal training business. And what I really liked about my online personal training business was the marketing part. I was ranking really well online. I learned SEO by myself. I was doing videos. I was doing social media. I was kind of doing a little bit of everything. And all of a sudden, like my clientele, my personal training clientele, instead of asking me fitness questions, most of them were business owners. They were asking me like, how I do this for SEO, or how come they see me so all over the place, like when they're searching for certain keywords, and they asked me about my email marketing and so forth. So I just got really, really kind of obsessed with it. And so I decided to like quit that career and apply to like a marketing agency, a real agency. And I got picked up by an SEO agency. So that was my first agency I worked at. And from there on out, I just kind of fell in love with it.
And 2023 was a pretty volatile year in search. We've asked a lot of our recent guests about the algorithm updates that happened in the second half of 2023. And I like to keep asking this question because you always hear kind of different answers and different perspectives on all of the change that's happened with, for example, like the helpful content update. And so I'm curious to ask you, what do you make of like the recent algorithm updates of 2023?
As an SEO person, I kind of swim against the current on this question. I've always tried to practice the best SEO practices possible. And so, you know, I always feel like if you use common sense, if you're not trying to cheat the curve, if you're really like doing SEO for users first and then for search engines, you should be in a good boat. So for me, like a lot of the new updates, I'm rarely afraid of an update, to be honest with you. So I actually like it when they make certain changes. It never really harms me or my clients.
So what are those practices?
Just be ethical. Content marketing, make sure your website is user-friendly. So that's like your technical SEO, right? So make sure site speed is good, stuff is easy to find, and also making your website accessible for the user. It's easy to navigate. It's easy to find content. It's easy for them to navigate, to contact you if they want to. So that's priority. And then the secondary part is, once you get that squared away, is, okay, how can we add more? And adding more is generally adding content. And adding content, perfect example in SEO is, of course, is blogging. So that's basically, if I were to really dumb it down and keep that answer short, it's those two things. But it always starts with the technical aspect, making sure your site is built for the user first, and then you start adding stuff for SEO and getting more impressions and more clicks to your site.
One of the complaints I have with SEO agencies is they often spend way too much time on technical SEO, especially in like the very beginning. And it feels like they're kind of just running through like a checklist or a checkbox to serve like the first 1 to 2 months of a client engagement. And they're not actually doing like the needle moving work. How would you respond to that?
I totally get that. It kind of depends on the client. So what a lot of agencies do is they have like a package, and it's like, we do these tasks and these are our monthly tasks. Everyone is forced to do these tasks every single month. And usually that entails like the technical SEO at the beginning, and then maybe a check-in every 3 to 6 months on redoing technical SEO. And that's not a bad thing, I don't think. At least you, like the person that's buying the SEO, understands what they're getting. And a lot of business owners just don't know what they're getting with SEO. So that's one way to do it. But the reality of it, from your question, is not everyone needs that. And so for our agency, we do everything like within the first month. We do the technical SEO, and then we also do that. We start generating content right away because we want to start moving the needle as quickly as possible. And I tell all my clients to expect at minimum an increase of like impressions, Google impressions and Google clicks, website traffic within the first 3 months. And to do that, we need to get started by generating new stuff to the website as quickly as possible. So we try to do it all at the very beginning. And then, you know, it starts to become more of a focus on adding new content as we move forward.
Well, 3 months is pretty fast. You know, like, I guess it depends on like what industry you're in. Like if you're in a fairly competitive industry, like I think if you know, you're cranking, you'd want to see that search impressions are climbing, or at least like Google is starting to pay attention maybe at the month 3 mark. But for a lot of companies, especially like SaaS companies, where I know you spend a lot of time, like they just might be in a really competitive space, and like, there's no way that they can really drive traffic in 3 months, especially if it's like a newer company or a newer site. How do you communicate expectations and timelines, especially to those companies that are just getting started?
You're right. It really depends on not just the market, but also like the individual client. So we try to make expectations pretty, you know, we try to make predictions, but we don't guarantee anything, right? So yeah, it really depends on that individual circumstance. So we do a thorough audit of not just the like website and your typical SEO audit that you can get from any agency or any freelancer, but we really try to understand the business, the product, and the ideal customer profile, and make sure all that information is updated before we even start with an SEO plan. So that's like always step number one for us. And well, a lot of cases where we find is because we work with a lot of startups, maybe a lot of small or medium-sized businesses where marketing resources kind of limited. A lot of that information, maybe they did once and then never really updated it, or maybe they never really sat down and took that exercise, like an ideal customer profile, really seriously. So we actually include that as part of the service. So we want to make sure that we're not just focusing on any type of traffic or any type of impressions. We want to make sure we're getting like at least the right type of impressions and traffic, because the ultimate goal, obviously, is to get some sort of conversions to the site.
Yeah, well, that's why we're doing this ultimately. We like to say on this podcast that traffic doesn't always equal dollars. Sometimes it does, though. So sometimes it does. But for a lot of companies, especially in like you know, more niche or highly technical SaaS industries, you might need to be a lot more thoughtful about the keywords you're targeting, the different stages of the funnel we want to focus on from a keyword point of view. But last question on technical SEO before I'll move on. Like, what are like one or two of those, like, you know, just obvious issues or big issues that you see your clients having or struggling with on the technical SEO side?
I would say because we have a bigger focus in B2B, the thought of optimizing your site for mobile, because everyone's like looking at their desktop all the time, gets skipped. And so that's usually like something that sticks out with a majority of our clientele is they're optimizing for their desktop, but they're not really thinking about their mobile device. And when we look into traffic, we can show, I mean, every client's different, but there is a significant percentage. Sometimes it's even more than 50% of their traffic is from mobile. So that's a big thing that sticks out. The other thing too is just probably an over-focus. They think of like SEO as just blogging, and then they're just adding blogging. So they kind of skip of all the fundamentals of technical SEO. You know, run a test like on Google Lighthouse. And if the score sucks, then you know that maybe there's some room for improvement there.
You are entering into some highly controversial SEO territory. A lot of SEOs will say Core Web Vitals don't matter and it's a total waste of time. What would you say to those SEOs?
I don't think I've heard that as too much of an argument. So I'm a little surprised. I don't even know how to answer that.
Well, I guess maybe it's mostly in like my circles. Cause you know, if you look, like there are plenty of examples of sites ranking phenomenally well with like terrible Core Web Vitals.
Oh yeah.
And performance metrics. And I kind of fall into the camp of if they're extremely bad, let's worry about them. But if they're not, then like, who cares? Like I just have yet to see a site get meaningful search gains by like improving like LCP from like 4 seconds to like 3.6.
Okay. Now I kind of get what you're saying. I think not everything needs to be at a certain score. I think everything needs to be looked at and see if there's room for improvement. That's really all I'm saying, because a faster performing site is technically should be a more of a user-friendly site. But if it's already fast and we're making it a little bit faster, that's not that important, right? So that's really what I'm looking at is like, we're not trying to get like a, you know, be in the green, you know, or whatever that scores threshold is for all clients, but we're looking to see if there is room for improvement. And a lot of times it could just be, dude, your images are so huge or your videos are just so long. It takes forever to look at it. And a lot of it too is just not what the score says, like when you're running a tool, but when you actually go to the site and it's loading and it's loading and it's loading and there it is. Can we improve on that? So that's part of it too.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I mean, even if it's not like a needle mover in terms of traffic, it's just providing ultimately a better experience, which might lead to, you know, more conversions or whatever it might be. And I do agree with you that like mobile is often overlooked. And you know, with Google search rater guidelines, like the guidelines team who's actually going through and like reviewing these search results manually, very, very hard job. They're actually reviewing results on mobile almost exclusively. So from a quality standpoint, it's very clear that like Google does treat mobile as kind of the primary experience that they focus on when reviewing sites. And I do want to chat about link building. You know, we don't talk enough about link building, at least I don't think, on this podcast. And I saw a post recently from you on LinkedIn. And for all our listeners, if you're not already following Jesse on LinkedIn, you absolutely should. And we'll include a link to his profile in the show notes. So I saw a post on LinkedIn where you mentioned like good and bad link building strategies. And we've got a lot here. I kind of merged two of your LinkedIn posts together. I think we've got like, I don't know, 10 or 12 different link building options as far as strategies go that we could talk about. And I kind of want to run through them rapid fire and just have you like quickly explain like what the strategy is and then like why it's either good or bad. Does that sound good?
Sure. I'll do my best.
The first one is creating shareable content. What do you mean here and why is it good?
Yeah, that's typically my most important thing is like, the content you're creating, is it shareable? And so some good examples of that is like, blogging is probably the ultimate example. Is this a good thought leadership piece? Is this something that people or your ideal customer profile is interested in? Just a general topic. Does it support that need? And then is there certain things within the content that's also shareable? And a good example of that is like, is there images? Are images shareable? Do you have, you know, custom images that can really connect with the user or the visitor? So that's really what I mean about shareable content is if people like it, then they're more likely to share it. And some other examples might be like providing data analytics. So that's another thing that works fairly well is like if you're providing unique data, like a percentage or some sort of research that you've done before, and maybe that's not the same type of data that you can get anywhere else that's your own from your own research, that's another kind of example of shareable content. So something that people would find the value of and be worth sharing, you know, either in their own blogging or somewhere else.
Industry guest blogging. You mentioned that this is a good link building strategy. What is it?
Guest blogging is kind of like there's that slippery slope. Is this a good or bad thing? I think it's generally a good thing as long as it's like your focus on other sites and other maybe bloggers within your own industry, because then there's a little bit more of a relatable link and it's not too forced. So reaching out to other, you know, businesses that are within your industry and seeing if you could provide value where they can link back to your site is generally a good practice.
This next one I need to kind of push back on because I've just never had success with, and I've built many thousands of links over the last 10 years, but I have almost never had success with broken link building. Does it actually work?
Yeah, it totally can. It's just you have to be persistent on it, and you have to, it's one of those things where a lot of it just depends on your email or your like contact that you're sending to, because most of the time you're not going to get a response. You have to have a really good email to get some sort of response. And that kind of goes with even like guest blogging. If you're reaching out to for guest blogging, kind of the same thing. So it can work. It's just persistency and then your own strategy for generating emails. It's one I struggle with too. And it's kind of like, I don't even know what the percentage is of success rate, but it's probably like 10 or 20%. So as far as how many people we contact about a broken link, but it's still something we still practice.
Well, 10 or 20% is pretty freaking good. You must have some great email scripts. And for all of our listeners that might not know what broken link building is, it's essentially like if your competitor, for example, has a link from a website that you would like a link on, but that website is linking to a page on that competitor's website, that might be, you know, no longer accessible or 404ing. What I would do is I would reach out to that website linking to my competitor's 404ing page and say to them something to the effect of, you should be linking to my page instead. And like Jesse mentioned, it can very much be a numbers game, but 10 to 20% is actually very, very good.
And one of the reasons why we have that percentage is like most people would just do like the same email over and over again. And ours is very customized as like, your link is broken. This is the reason why it's bad. And then here's a link for us and it references the same thing compared to your broken link. So we kind of make it customized like that.
Jesse, do you do a whole lot of like traditional like resource page outbound link building? Is that something you focus on?
No.
I spent so much time there from like, you know, 2016 to 2019. And like, I haven't done it lately, like not in the last few years, but I've heard that it just does not work as well anymore because everybody kind of figured it out. And like the golden age of resource page link building might be over because these individuals who might be willing to give you a link are just spammed to death. But like broken link building, it's different because you're actually helping them maybe solve an issue with their site.
Yeah, I mean, there's certain industries that could work. I used to work I was a general manager of an agency where we focus on healthcare, and having reference pages was pretty standard on healthcare websites. So I can actually see that as still probably working for that industry. But generally, like, I think a lot of industries just don't have a resource page, or that's probably not like an outdated practice to do link building on.
Yeah, some of my favorite resources or resource centers would be libraries, also towns. For example, like I built a link on this like city in Texas. They had like a resources hub for teens in their town. And that was a great place to like plug a link for a financial product for teens. I do want to ask about some of the ways that we shouldn't be building links. The first that you mentioned is purchasing links. In my personal opinion, like our listeners have heard me say before, like I don't recommend to like our customers that they should be buying links, but a lot of our guests have pushed back and said, like, you should be buying links. It works. Why not? And if in this world of 2024, Google's not really doing manual link penalties anymore, at least that's what we've seen, it doesn't matter. Like, if it doesn't count, it doesn't count. So this is kind of controversial, but I agree with you. But and I want to know why we shouldn't be purchasing links, in your opinion.
Yeah, just I think for the overall general concept is you just don't know what you're getting or the value that you're actually getting. So generally, and not this is not true for all people that offer it a service, but generally it's more of a spammy approach where they have a list of sites, you pay for it, they put a link on. Whether or not that link is referenced at all to the content or not, they don't care. They just want to send you the link. Whether or not like the website itself is relevant to your website or your services, they don't care about that either. So when that's usually the majority of the, I would say, the reality of purchasing links. Now, there's also the other side where I'm sure there's plenty of link providers where you could actually find a super valuable link. It's a little bit more organic looking, or at least the concept is a little more organic. So that might be the exception to the rule. But for me, it just seems like it's a little too spammy. And whether or not Google realizes it now, maybe they will in the future, or maybe it will be recognized and it will cost you when it comes to like rankings and so forth.
Yeah, I think Google's gotten very good at just ignoring links. I think the days of like, you know, manual actions from paid links are, I don't want to say it's over because I'm sure you can still get one, but it just seems like Google isn't as actively penalizing sites for buying links as maybe they used to. But I think that just comes back to Google's just gotten very good at maybe identifying what is a paid link, at least a lot better than maybe they could when I first started in this space. The next one I want to ask you about is link exchanges and reciprocal linking. We work with a lot of startups, and those startups are always swapping links back and forth. They ask me to swap links with them. Like, I say no. You know, if you come on my podcast, you'll get a link, and you'll get a link today from us, Jesse. But like, should we be swapping links? Is there like a threshold where if we cross it, then we might want to worry about it? I guess, what do you think here?
Yeah, this is an interesting one. And this is actually one that I used to do years ago because it made sense to me. But then as more people do it, then you can see how people abuse it, right? So I think that the where it becomes an issue is like, if you really abuse it and like you're constantly sending links over and over again, reciprocating links over and over again, that's really when it becomes a problem. But sometimes it just happens organically. Like, I like your business, you like mine. I like the content on yours, you like mine. And from Google's point of view, how would they know that if we had a relationship or not? And this is a strategy where we're just kind of doing it organically. So there is that approach, but I feel like if you're abusing it, you have multiple location or multiple businesses that you're constantly doing this, like there's a lot of posts and pages on their site where they're linking to you and it's the same concept, you're doing the same thing to them. That's when it becomes an obvious approach where you're kind of forcing the issue instead of letting it happen organically.
You're about halfway into this week's episode of the Optimized Podcast, and I just want to let you know about our Buyer Journey product. It's a really cool one, and it just came out. It gives you insight into where users are traveling throughout your website. You can look at entry and exit flows. So for example, if you want to see all of the different pages that a user has traveled down by the time they've reached your Book a Demo page, you could do that. Or for example, if you want to see the pages that users go down or travel through after reaching your homepage, you can see that too. Positional's Buyer Journey product is meant to give you insights in terms of how users are engaging with your site and how they ultimately end up to their final destination. We'd love for you to check it out at positional.com. And now back to the rest of this week's episode. And by the way, you've got some gems on LinkedIn, and I want to talk about another one. You recently posted on LinkedIn that you're a big user of AI generated content, including that you actually write content with AI writing tools. Do you find that AI generated content is actually working for your clients?
Yes. And let's clear it up though. Like, I'm from the school of thought, if you can create your own content from a human being and it's good, then that's probably the better approach. The problem with AI content is a lot of it's repetitive. It's like a lot of the content you're getting is kind of the same or similar content that someone else has written. And so my approach with using AI for generating content is looking at as AI as like a tool. It's a tool in your tool bag. It shouldn't replace your own content writing. It should enhance it. I'm a big fan of generating content because it is faster and it is generally written fairly well. But the big part of it is I like to call it what I call humanize the AI content. Whereas I kind of apply to the 80-20 rule where 80% of the content is generated from AI and the other 20% is from a human. And that's kind of a general approach. It could be way different than that, but that's kind of like the overall general approach. Whereas you imply, you know, you edit it so it flows better. If there's repeatable content, you delete it. If there's spelling errors and grammar errors, you fix it, right? You apply, you know, make it more visually appealing, whether you turn some of the content into lists, you shorten it if it's a ton of paragraphs. You still do all that type of stuff. And that's where the human comes in to not only make it better or well written, like make it look like it came from a human being, but also that's part of the optimization process as well.
I was going to ask you about your process here. And I saw also that you mentioned on LinkedIn that humanizing your AI generated content was super important in all of this. So I appreciate you going into depth with me there. I want to ask about indexing. And we have enough customers at Positional now that I know that like a lot of the customers of ours who are using AI generated content have run into a lot of indexing issues. Either like the content doesn't index for 6 months or they kind of have to force index it through a couple of hacky methods. Like, have you seen indexing issues with AI generated content?
Yes. And it's been one of those things where I don't have it completely figured out, because for some of my customers, it's not an issue, and some other customers, it is an issue. And so it's kind of like hit or miss, and I haven't seen any consistencies of why it's working for one certain customer and not for the other, especially if they're like within a similar type of business. Yeah, I have definitely noticed it, but I haven't really solved it yet.
What do you think about like the uniqueness of that content? Like I say to our customers, you want to create content that's uniquely helpful. Like, how do you go about making your content uniquely helpful in that humanization process?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think a lot of it is, and this applies pretty well in B2B, and you can also see this a lot on LinkedIn. I kind of use LinkedIn as my experiment on content. And what you'll notice on LinkedIn is people like your opinion on things. Not all people like the factual stuff, right? They want to hear from what you have to say about certain things. And so I try to apply that same thing within the blogging content itself. We're not just doing like a factual type of piece here. Maybe there's some of that, but a lot of it is like, what is the business's take on this? Or what is the owner's take of this? And I try to get them to apply that within the content. So most of my customers, I'll send the draft to them before it, but I have different sections where like they need to apply their own thoughts in. Sometimes it's quotes, so got to have their quotes within it. And then I'll have certain sections where I know this is a little too AI heavy. Can you make some changes to these two paragraphs, imply your own thoughts in there, or send it to your marketing team and they do it? And that's how I try to deal with it to get more uniqueness within the content.
Yeah. So it sounds like you're putting the AI generated content through an editorial process, which is actually how like most companies don't want to be using AI generated content. I actually think that like AI generated content is the worst thing to happen to early stage startups because they don't put it through a process. Like I've seen companies publish like hundreds, thousands of articles with AI to their site overnight. And like, you know, a year later, still none of those pages have indexed. This might be one where I want to disagree with you, and I just generally don't like AI generated content. But I think like the thoughtful process you've described is a good one if it is something you want to use.
Yeah, and I will just end it with this if I can, and I kind of stated this already, but the way my approach, and I think this is the best approach, because AI is not going anywhere. So it's only going to get better and better. At least that's my opinion. If you disagree, I get it. So you know, the way I look at it is it shouldn't replace the uniqueness or the human approach. It should be an enhancement to your content. So where businesses get in trouble is they use it as a replacement of their own writing, or they double down on it and get, okay, instead of doing one post a week, we can do 4, 5, or 6. And that's where they're really kind of abusing it.
Yeah. Well, I definitely don't disagree with you that the AI writing tools are going to get better. You know, people have been speculating that GPT-5 is finally going to replace humans. So we'll see. And I want to talk about SaaS companies in particular. I know that's a focus area for you, Jesse, and also Spearpoint Marketing. How do you build out a strategy for an early stage SaaS company? Could you walk us through that process?
Yeah, it kind of starts with the general fundamentals of marketing. What I want to know is about the brand, what's your ideal customer profile, and then how can we make sure that your brand represents that and your website represents that, and then customize an SEO strategy that's based on that plan. So what I don't do, where I think a lot of agencies do this, if they don't, especially if they don't specialize in a certain market, is they start immediately with the keyword research and they're applying all the keywords, and then they're like, okay, how can we map these keywords or create a content plan with these keywords just to generate as much traffic as possible? That doesn't really work for SaaS because it's hard to convert customers. So you got to have more of like approach of like, not only are we trying to rank for these keywords, but are these keywords, you know, the same type of keywords that the customer or their potential customers are actually searching for? And then is the value of the content, is it enough for them to keep stay engaged or to come back to it or to reference it or eventually have some sort of conversion within it? So that's why we kind of start with that one-on-one marketing approach before we start doing the SEO stuff.
And how much does an early stage SaaS company, I realize you probably work with companies that are not just early stage, but how much would like an early stage SaaS company need to invest in the content and SEO channel to really see signs that it's working for them?
Yeah, we have our packages range from like 1,000 a month to like 3,000 a month within that area there. I would say like at the minimum for SaaS, it's somewhere in between there. So somewhere between 1500 and 2000 a month is where you would want to be in SaaS. If you're really in a more competitive environment, then we probably would push you a little bit higher. If it's an extreme case in SaaS, it's not always the case, but if it's an extreme case, then it could be a little bit lower, but it's generally somewhere within that 1500 to 2 grand a month is kind of a, you know, a majority approach.
That seems really affordable, I want to say. Like, we've had guests on this podcast that have, you know, told us point blank, like, you know, I think we had one guest say like 10,000 a month. That's like the baseline. We had another guest that was like 50,000 a month as like the baseline for like the SaaS companies they work with. It could be an amazing deal, but like it just feels like it's really affordable. And so I guess like if a client had previously been quoted 10K and then they come to you and it's like 3,000, it's like, is there any difference or it's just a different price?
It could be completely different. A lot of it too is like, what else is included there? Are they creating a ton of content? Like, are they creating like content every single day? Is there something else that comes with it? Does like social media come with it? Because a lot of like, especially like SaaS companies or even SaaS SEO agencies will say that they have a whole content distribution that comes with the marketing or the SEO as well. Ours is a little bit, we do a little bit of posting on social, but it's more for just to stay in line with the SEO purposes. So a lot of it just kind of depends on what the package really is. But if I looked, I could look at my pricing, a lot of other, my B2B competitors, we're all with what we offer, we're all within the same kind of realm with our pricing. It's just that the pricing gets higher, obviously, if there's a lot more stuff that comes with it.
Would you say the fact that like, you know, AI generated content as a starting point to the editorial process is what allows you to maybe offer like a slightly lower or a more affordable price versus like an agency that's not using AI generated content whatsoever?
Yeah, absolutely. If I was in a boat of having to hire, because I'm really kind of picky with our content. So if I was going to do human content for everybody, that writer can't just be a writer. They have to be a writer that's familiar enough with that market for it to work, at least for me. And that gets really expensive. So yes, you are correct. Having things like AI and then some of our other processes internally allows us to have that price. It's definitely built into it.
Yeah. I love that we have to call it human content.
Yeah, I know, right?
And you mentioned like marketing and social media, like, and, you know, now that we're creating all this content, does it make sense for SaaS companies to, you know, actively be thinking about how they could repurpose that content to other channels? Or is that something you encourage your customers to do?
Yeah, I do. Especially if it's, you know, not that there's ranges on how you do that, right? So like a lot of B2B companies kind of just do the general approach of link to a blog post and go, we're sharing our content. I mean, that's kind of like the lowest of the lowest effort, right? It's better than nothing, but that's just about it. We definitely want you to distribute content because it's written. It's already there. I find it valuable. You find it valuable. Share it more to your audience so you can get more people to see it and connect with it and see your brand and so forth. We have some practices where we help our clients to just say, hey, see this piece within our content. You could actually use this image here because it's relevant to this piece. It could be like the top three things within a blog post about something. We find this very shareable with your LinkedIn audience, for example, or Facebook audience, or whatever that is. We recommend that you share that and don't link it to your site because one thing about LinkedIn and Facebook is LinkedIn doesn't like their users to leave their platform to go somewhere else. They want you to stay on their own platform, right? So that's another thing that we kind of teach a little bit with all our clients.
That is so true. You never want to include the link back to your site in that LinkedIn post. What about having like your best buddy jump in and ask for a link to that full blog post in the comments? Does that work?
Yeah, that should work within the comments. The algorithm is constantly changing with LinkedIn. This last algorithm change was like around Christmas time. And man, it cut my like impressions by like, I don't know, cut it down to like 10% for what I was doing. But from what I've seen now with my own experience, at least up to this point, is that that's not something that LinkedIn will dock you on. But it's definitely probably potential. It's something they might dock you on in the future because, again, the overall approach is LinkedIn doesn't want you to leave their platform. They want users to stay on their platform, see their ads, see all that other stuff, right? So
I want to keep talking about LinkedIn because you've done a really good job with your LinkedIn channels. And I think we could learn a lot here. Should I post on LinkedIn and then go and ask like a bunch of my friends to like go and like and comment and engage on it? Like, you know, within like 20 minutes, like, does that help like send some sort of positive signal to the algorithms that this is a good one? Or is that just wasted energy?
Well, there's some issues with that. I don't think it's a bad thing to do maybe every once in a while or maybe your first couple of posts, but there's that same kind of like the reciprocal link building. Like if you're constantly commenting on the same people and they're commenting on yours, then LinkedIn that's not going to help grow your audience, right? LinkedIn is going to say like, he knows these people, they know him, and that's it, right? So you kind of get stuck, and you could see it with your own newsfeed, is that if you comment on the same people over and over again, when you pop on in the morning and you go to LinkedIn, you're going to see all the people that you always comment on, like your first it every morning. And I guarantee that's their approach. So you definitely want to, when it comes to engaging, you want to engage as with as many people as you can and kind of either have such good, valuable content that people find it organically and share it. You definitely want to have that, but you also want to constantly be, you know, networking with new people, especially if you want to like grow your brand on LinkedIn.
Right. How often do you need to post on LinkedIn? Is there like an optimal number of times per week? Can you post too much? Like, is every day too much? I know I just asked you three questions in one, but the first one is how often should you be posting on LinkedIn? And I guess the second question is, can you post too much?
I love this question and I hate this question at the same time. And the reason why is because a majority of people on LinkedIn say you got to post every day. And I think that's bull crap. If you built a following and you have, you know, you can freaking post, just take a picture of your cat, and then a ton of people will say, oh my God, that's so great. It was so cute, because they want to like build their own kind of own network that by, you know, commenting on yours, that can work. But it's valuable content. If you can make a valuable piece of content that's really good, that's better than other people that within your market or area or wherever you write about, if it's always better, then, and you can do that every single day, then definitely write daily. But I can't do that. I could probably do maybe two pieces a week. And that's my general approach, is like, I know I can do with the resources that I have with my own running a business and taking care of my customers. I know I'm good for like two good pieces of content a week. And that's all I can do. And it's really helped me grow on the platform. If I tried to do that every day, like I was trying to do that every day at the beginning of last year, my impressions didn't go anywhere, because maybe one post a week was actually decent, but all the other posts were crap.
I agree. And, you know, I always get a little chuckle when I see like some of our competitors posting on LinkedIn every day, but like the quality of content just isn't that good. You can tell that they're kind of like stretching just to do something every day. And I think it ultimately, from a brand standpoint, even if you are getting impressions, like from a brand standpoint, you're not putting your best foot forward. And I think I'm biased because I'm talking about my competitors here, but like, I feel like you can almost come across as like not as smart as you actually are if you are having to force yourself to post every single day. Jesse, this has been so much fun. I appreciate you putting up with my prying questions. And if it's okay with you, I would love to ask you a few rapid fire questions to kind of finish things off. Does that sound good?
Sounds good.
Graphics, how important are they on LinkedIn?
Graphics, that's a good question. They're definitely important. It depends on how to use them. Like, I use carousels. That's a big part of my approach with LinkedIn. And it allows me to just, not only, I think carousels are definitely favorable. Like, when someone sees a carousel, they're more likely to stop scrolling and see, what does this guy have to say, right? So I think that approach still works. I'm not sure if it's going to, that's still going to work well in 2024. We'll see, but it's definitely within my strategy. Images can work. I don't get them to work that well, but I've definitely seen plenty of other users that have like their own graphic as just one image, and that works for them. But it all kind of depends on what your quality is and what's the value of that image.
Jess, you are also the host of your own podcast called Brands and Brews Marketing Podcast, which we'll include a link to in the show notes. What's your favorite brew? What are you going to be drinking on Friday night?
That's a good question. I've actually taken a break from the podcast. I'm getting ready to launch it this quarter. I just got so busy, but I've kind of building some processes internally. I've gotten some resource help to get back on the podcast. So for me, I try to drink a new beer every single episode. And what I also try to do is drink something that relatable to my guests. So I've had some interesting guests like from all over the world. I'm just thinking of one guest I had that was in Prague. And so I was like, great, I'm going to find a beer within that area and see if I can at my liquor store and look around. And sure enough, I found one. And so she loved it. We talked about it. She knew a little bit about it, about the brand. We talked about the brand, and it just caused like an organic conversation. So I'm up for anything. If they're not a drinker, then I just kind of I just go to a local beer, because I live in Denver, Colorado. We have tons of breweries, and I'll get something here locally.
What's the best brewery in Denver, Colorado?
I would say Great Divide. They have a lot of good beers there. And Great Divide, too, is I think you could pretty much get them outside of Colorado as well. So I think I've seen them in the West Coast. I think I've seen them a little bit on the East Coast too. So I would definitely say it's my favorite brewery.
I'll have to try that one. Maybe we should start drinking on this podcast.
Well, if you want to see it like just a crap show or listen to one, I would recommend listen to the first season of Brands of Brews, because I had a co-host at that time and we would drink way too much during that whole season. So since then, it's like maybe one beer an episode.
That is amazing. The whole season one, we'll need to take a look at.
Yes.
And my last question for you, and it's an intentionally pretty vague one, but is SEO dead?
No, it's just like it always is. It's always changing. I've been doing marketing or SEO since 2008, and I've heard SEO is dead countless times. So it just changes. And that's really all I have to say about that.
For all our listeners, could you tell us a little bit more about like Spearpoint Marketing and how they can get in touch if they want to get in touch with you?
Yeah. So at Spearpoint Marketing, we've already talked about the pricing. So we do find ourselves affordable, right? Or at least we like to think so. But we mostly focus on B2B. So SaaS definitely, like SaaS B2B definitely fits in there. We also do e-commerce as well. So those are kind of the two areas that we like to focus on. You could find us, for one, you could just look up Spearpoint Marketing. It's easy to find. You can find us on LinkedIn, and then the URL is thespearpoint.com.
Yep, and we'll include a link to that in the show notes, along with a few of these different social posts that we've mentioned, a link to the Brands and Brews podcast, and probably a few other links too. But Jesse, thank you so much for coming on. This was a lot of fun.
I appreciate it, Nate.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Optimize podcast. Just a quick reminder that Positional's public launch is on March 26th, and we'd love for you to check it out. On March 26th, you'll be able to sign up for our product without talking to me, which is very exciting. And we've got a number of tools for content marketing and SEO teams, including tools for keyword research, internal linking, content analytics, and our new Buyer Journeys product, which I think you're really going to like. So check out positional.com either before the public launch or on our launch day on March 26th.